Welcome to Build with Bitcoin. In today's episode, we speak with Brian Cabellas and Brad Myers, both partners at Early Riders. Early Riders is an investment fund that will raise, deploy, and return capital in Bitcoin terms. They share with us their thesis behind this new type of vehicle and how it will operate. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of Build with Bitcoin with co-host Israel Munoz and myself, Lynn Bairstow. Today we have a really interesting episode for you about a fund that's launching called Early Riders, which is going to be the first fund focused on not just Bitcoin in terms of what the companies are that are invested in, but also how the fund is structured, being that it will be funded in Bitcoin and deployed in Bitcoin. So we're curious to talk about this. It's the first of its kind that we know about. And Brian Cabellas and Brad Myers are here, two of the managing partners, and to share with us kind of the idea behind Early Riders and how they see this new type of fund structure really changing venture and changing investment. So Israel, anything to add?
No, well, welcome Brian and Brad. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you for having us. Really excited to chat with you guys.
Yeah.
You guys are definitely a different form of an investment fund than anything we've seen before. And it sounds like the first of its kind, really, is using Bitcoin as a unit of account. So, you know, maybe before we get into what the fund is about, the why, and how you guys plan on deploying that capital, it'd be great to start with maybe a little bit about both of you guys and who the founding team is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can kick things off, and Brad, you can follow. So yeah, I started my career in the traditional finance world, worked for a big private bank in New York called Brown Brothers Harriman for about 8 years, largely on sort of the allocation side. So conducting diligence across the asset class spectrum on behalf of private banking clients. So we managed around $60 billion in AUM, and that was, you know, mostly high net worth individuals, but some smaller endowments and foundations mixed in there. But it was a really unique approach to private banking generally, I would say, in that, you know, it was a very flat team structure. So I worked directly with our CIO and a few other colleagues, and we were really tasked with going out and diligencing sort of the world of fund managers, again, across the asset class spectrum, and deciding, you know, who to bring onto our platform. And it was a very sort of purposefully concentrated and narrow sort of set of managers that we would bring on, because we had a very strict investment philosophy. And so Brown Brothers was, it's actually, I think, the oldest and largest private bank in the U.S. It was founded in 1818. And so it is sort of conservative in nature and slow moving in some sense, but also very sort of practical in how they think about investing. They're sort of value oriented, sort of disciples of Warren Buffett, if you will. So very cash flow biased and thinking about sustainable business models and really having a long term approach to wealth management and really value accrual. And so that's kind of where I honed my own personal investment philosophy over those 8 or so years. Was really, you know, the day job was going out, scouring the universe and really picking the brains of some of the smartest investors in the world, understanding what they look for in business models, understanding, you know, how businesses achieve certain competitive advantages, build wide moats, obtain pricing power. And so that was really where I sort of made my knitting in terms of understanding how to invest. And then it was probably late 2017, early 18, when I heard about this thing called Bitcoin. I kicked myself. I mean, I studied history and economics in college, and none of my professors ever mentioned really Austrian economics or anything related to Bitcoin. So didn't come to it until sort of that 2017 mania towards the end of the year. And it just struck me as something that I needed to pay attention to and learn more about, because I really had no idea what it was other than a number on a screen. And so I knew it was sort of this, I could feel in my gut, it was a transformative technology that I need to understand. And so I sort of in my personal time just started digging into Bitcoin and frankly, sort of the rest of the quote unquote crypto rabbit hole, and sort of into 18, 19, I started to recognize that, Bitcoin was fundamentally different through that ensuing bear market. I think one of the things that clicked for me was, okay, all of this stuff has come down from these sort of wild valuations. Bitcoin seems to have been battered the least. You know, why is that? Are there reasons why Bitcoin went down less than sort of every other crypto asset I had heard of? And so I started to dig into really the origins of money, read Saifedean's book, and started to understand Austrian economics at a deeper level, and really started to go down the real rabbit hole of understanding Bitcoin was fundamentally different. And so I did that for a few years, was still at the bank, you know, speaking with my CIO and other colleagues. It was, you know, I would try to bring up Bitcoin, and it largely fell on deaf ears, I think, for a few reasons. Like, one, again, the conservative nature of the institution was certainly a factor. And then the other factor was, again, being sort of cash flow oriented in their investment philosophy, they never had any exposure to gold or other hard asset commodities. The concept of digital gold really didn't do much for them because they didn't have any gold in the portfolio. So I kind of started to realize in 2020, 21 that, you know, if I wanted to sort of be very serious about this thing I was becoming increasingly passionate about, I probably needed to make a jump from the traditional finance space at some point. And so I took a job in 2022, actually, at Coinbase, which was interesting in the sense that at that point, I was already sort of heavily convicted in Bitcoin specifically and very skeptical of the rest of crypto. But I saw it as a great opportunity to really test my own assumptions and sort of codify my thesis around why Bitcoin was different. And so, you know, I forced myself to dig into some of these other protocols and understand the nuances of, frankly, like the flawed incentive models at the basis of these protocols. And so I was at Coinbase for about 12 months and always sort of knew in the back of my head that this was going to be a stepping stone to something that was Bitcoin specific and Bitcoin focused. And sort of towards the end of that tenure at Coinbase, I started scouring the Bitcoin space specifically and thinking about not only, you know, where I could add value, but, you know, genuinely looking for sound business models. I heard Michael Tanguma, who's a partner at Early Riders and also co-founder of OnRamp Bitcoin, where I should mention I'm also chief strategy officer at OnRamp, in addition to being partner at Early Riders. But I heard Michael and his co-founder, Jesse Myers, on a podcast a little over a year ago now, talking about this concept of multi-institution custody. And for sort of just to put that in layman's terms, what that means is it's really a hybrid form of custody wherein you're not taking possession of key materials yourself as the client, but you're trusting three distinct institutions to manage a 2 of 3 multi-sig quorum on your behalf. And what that does is it eliminates single points of failure, including yourself as the individual. If you were managing your keys yourself, you yourself become a single point of failure. But really where I saw this as a important step forward in terms of sort of the evolution of custody in Bitcoin was that I noticed this large gap in the market from my time at Coinbase and also going back to Brown Brothers of, you know, these larger pools of capital getting comfortable with allocating in size to this asset. Their options were just, you know, not great. To put it lightly, you either trusted Coinbase unilaterally with your funds or you went into the Grayscale Trust, which was not a great financial product for a number of reasons that I think people have come to realize over time. Or, you know, you try to figure out key management yourself, which is just not a super realistic or palatable path to go down for most institutional allocators. Thinking about a firm with an investment committee of 7 people, who's going to be in charge of the keys? How do you manage turnover of that group of 7 people? So this new form of custody that OnRamp was beginning to pioneer just struck me as something that really needed to exist. And frankly, I was surprised it took us this long as an industry to get to a model like this where you can really reduce counterparty risk while also sort of abstracting away some of the technical difficulties of key management itself. And so I reached out to Michael and Jesse and said, you know, however I can help you guys build this business, I want to help. And that was, you know, an interesting step for me personally, just given, you know, I'd been at 2 other institutions in my career and they're both fairly large. So this was a step for me saying, you know, I want to go get my hands dirty and help build something. And so it's been an awesome experience sort of over the past year or so helping build that business. And where sort of the early riders comes into this is very early on in my relationship with Michael. We talked about, you know, investing in the Bitcoin space broadly, but I had kind of mentioned to him, like, yes, I want to get into building a business with you. But I'm always going to have sort of this nagging itch to get back to the allocator side and do some investing. And so, you know, we initially thought, this was a year ago or so, that, you know, it would look somewhat like what had already existed, in the sense that there are Bitcoin only venture funds out there and have a great deal of respect for what they've accomplished and what they're doing. But our sort of thesis evolved into something a little bit different, in the sense that the way I like to describe what we're trying to accomplish with early riders is really, you know, if you think about those handful of Bitcoin only venture funds, what they've really done is apply traditional venture investing methodologies to the world of Bitcoin. And what we are really trying to do is apply Bitcoin to the broader private investment landscape. And so if you just think about it from the notion of, you know, Bitcoin is a technology, money is a technology, and the internet sort of in the heyday of the internet sort of getting started, there was this concept of an internet company. But slowly what happened is that every business became an internet company. And I think we're seeing the same thing happen with AI. There's AI companies that are purely focused on that, but ultimately every business, if they want to be successful and compete, need to leverage AI tools. So they also become an AI company. I think that's what we're going to see with Bitcoin. I think every company that exists today is to some extent a Bitcoin company, in that they have the ability to leverage a better form of money, the best form of money in our mind. And so the thesis really comes down to that underlying sort of core anchor point of our belief in Bitcoin as the best form of money, and then building on top of that and saying, basically, you know, the world of venture over the past few decades has become a little bit bloated or complicated, in the sense that you're dealing with effectively infinitely printable money and incessant debasement of the currency. And so you're flooding, you know, businesses that may not warrant that level of capital deployment, you're flooding them with money, and not necessarily seeing the actual value creation that should occur through sort of private investment, generally speaking. The idea was, if we believe Bitcoin is the best form of money, we should structure an investment firm that denominates with Bitcoin as the unit of account. So we, as you mentioned, are raising capital in Bitcoin terms, deploying it in Bitcoin terms, and returning capital to our LPs in Bitcoin terms. And so that's, it's you know, and we'll get into sort of the other sort of tenets of the thesis and why that makes sense to us. But I'll stop there. That's a long rant of my journey. I'll let Brad hop in.
No, well, thanks for going over that, Brian. I mean, it's clear you come from a conservative value-oriented investment mind, which feeds directly into the thesis of early riders, right? But yeah, Brad, I mean, it'd be great to you know, understand where you come from in early riders.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and thanks, Brian. I think that's a great summation of what we're looking to do. But a little bit more about me and how I kind of come into the fold here. I was born in the ski towns of Colorado, and so naturally I had to go away from home. I ended up in the Midwest for school, but graduated in 2009. And so I think as a finance major, being in the, like, you know, your senior year, looking towards that next step in your life and seeing the entire financial world met down, having teachers come in and kind of explain to you what's going on. And ultimately, it was a really large signpost, I think, in my life of just saying, like, you know, this just really doesn't make sense when they just paper this thing over. And so I think when I look back kind of throughout my career, there's been a few of those signposts that have popped up. And really kind of like leading me down this Bitcoin path, but was able to get out of school. I ended up in Chicago, worked a little bit in corporate finance, but then ultimately ended up starting a business with a childhood friend of mine that was within the apparel business for import-export, so specifically licensing for destination retail companies. So if you're able to go to Vail, Jackson Hole, we were a large supplier of headwear to those industries, specifically on a licensing basis. And so I think another signpost was really like, well, okay, great. We went and built this business from scratch. We knew what these hats were, landed in Long Beach. We really had this thing as a well-oiled machine. And ultimately, like, we were able to grow it. We kind of realized that, yeah, we didn't know everything, but we were able to go out, go build, go figure some things out, provide some value. And ultimately, I wanted to go on and do bigger things, go get some big business experience. So I ultimately sold out my equity share in that business and ended up in graduate school down in Texas. Ultimately ended up at Deloitte Consulting post-graduation, moved to Austin, and spent a few years in the strategy and operations consulting practice, but also did a stint within the corporate development group, buying companies on behalf of the firm, really focused on managed service models to help complement that one-to-one consulting service model. And I think, again, it was a great experience. I was able to hone my craft, again, get some more of that bigger business experience, learn about more working with executives versus just, you know, two guys building a business, you know, within a niche industry. But ultimately wanted to get back to the operating side. So I ended up going to a variety of different technology companies within marketplace and enterprise software companies. And I think what I saw there kind of shocked me. I think, you know, in my past time being an entrepreneur, I knew the ins and outs of my business. It made money. If it didn't make money, I wasn't going to be able to survive, or the business wouldn't survive. And I was at a couple of companies where, you know, was able to see, I would say, the symptoms of money printing. Whether that be just not cash flowing businesses or ultimately businesses that operate at a loss, it really started to kind of hammer home this whole, again, idea of you know, what is, you know, the fundamental purpose of a business? Well, it should be to create value and generate some sort of profit. And so I think, again, those kind of signposts throughout my career really ultimately, again, had led me to Bitcoin. Was fortunate enough to go to high school with a fairly prominent, you know, person within the broader Bitcoin space, and learned about what, you know, that individual was doing early on. I really had started to look into Bitcoin more around 2016, time frame, 2017. And so ultimately really started to, again, dig deep, research, understand it. But by 2018, 2019 was fully sold that this is exactly the solution. I think at the time, even though I was at some of these tech companies, didn't necessarily like maybe connect the dots between some of the sailor maneuvers or the balance sheet. But ultimately by the moment that it did happen, I remember I was sitting at my desk and hearing Michael Saylor putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet. It was a complete aha moment for me. And that, hey, this is far beyond, you know, what individuals are going to do to protect their purchasing power, but ultimately do as well. And so as that, you know, again, thesis and just more and more time, thought process evolved within Bitcoin, decided to fire myself and ultimately take some time off and was very fortunate enough to end up at Swan for a little while, leading the client solutions team there. And really just saw such a great opportunity to, one, help them build what they're building over there, but then ultimately met Michael, met Mitch Kaufman as well, another partner at Early Riders. And it really transitioned, at least the course of my trajectory within the space, to say, hey, we need more builders in Bitcoin, and we need to go figure out ways to go ultimately raise capital, find great entrepreneurs that think in a Bitcoin manner, and ultimately go find that next wave of businesses. And so, since met Michael back in October, and we had a coffee and we were talking just kind of through how we kind of viewed the world, very similar, again, kind of going back to my days within the import export business. Let's get back to sound fundamentals. Don't overgrow, actually grow with intent, get really focused on what your core products are going to be, and ultimately build a business that's going to be sustainable. And I think ultimately that's what Early Riders and our portfolio companies will embody, is this idea of you can go out and raise a ton of money. Yes, that's certainly a possibility, but the ability to go operate on Bitcoin standard is tough. It's the tough way to do things, but ultimately you're going to be building very strong, fundamentally sound businesses that are focused and provide value, because you'll get the product market fit feedback very quickly. So a little bit of kind of tying it all together, and excited to, you know, dig more into the fund and kind of our thesis and kind of what we're looking at.
Yeah, and I want to dig deeper into this whole conversation about how operating on a Bitcoin standard changes not only venture capital or how we invest in companies, but also the companies themselves. But before we get there, can you guys share a little bit more about the other two partners in the fund? And if you would, I mean, you two both have different backgrounds, but very complementary. Can you just share a little bit about how the pieces fit together among the partners? Because I think partners are the key to what makes a fund successful.
Yeah, I think I'll take that one in terms of giving kind of a dichotomy of the partner makeup. I think it's very unique. I mean, obviously Brian's background in traditional finance, allocating side, and obviously his time at Coinbase, highly valuable. I myself kind of come from more of this pure play operator, you know, strategy person who sat in the offices, had to go deploy, build with speed. Mitch Kochman, I think 11 years at IBM building infrastructure. And then ultimately ended up BitGo, really being the seeds of what OnRamp has started to utilize with multi institution custody, and also serviced a number of other different companies within the Bitcoin space as their as a trusted advisor, but also really kind of on the infrastructure side to say, hey, this is how we need to go build these things. And then ultimately Michael Tangumo, who was, I think, employee number 7 at Unchained Capital, someone who's really saw early on like the importance of custody. But then also understanding that, again, we're very early in the Bitcoin maturation process of the market, and really brings this big idea, we'll call it energy, to the fund and being able to go find the right entrepreneurs, identify where there could be opportunities in the space. And when you kind of combine that all together, you have big ideas, the ability to go raise capital, people who have been on the technical side, and allocators and operators. So, I mean, you have a really nice dichotomy of individuals that work well together. And I think internally and how we interact with each other, it's always just really healthy discussion and debate. I think at every point in time, we're really just trying to get to that right answer, what we believe is the correct direction and the place that we should be heading. So, Brian, anything to add to that?
No, that was a very, very great summary of sort of the complementary nature of the partners of early riders. I think you spoke to it perfectly in the sense that, you know, I think I bring a bit of a more traditional investing, allocating sense, and really the three of you have done a combination of building, operating. It is a nice combination, the four of us.
And so the thesis, well, you know, we can expand on certain points of that, but before I am curious, Brian and Brad, why, so no one's done this before, right? Using Bitcoin as a unit of account. Why now? I mean, is it that you believe now Bitcoin, the asset, has a strong enough track record? The tools, maybe the custody tools, are finally there. Other reasons why are you deciding to launch this kind of fund now?
Yeah, I can start. I think one component certainly is the custody. I think something that we've thought critically about, not only at Early Riders but on the OnRamp side, obviously, is this notion of Bitcoin custody. You know, we're 15 years into this thing, this monetary experiment, you know, this evolving technology. And I think the custodial solutions that have existed for the first 15 years are representative of the immaturity of the asset class, in the sense that, you know, small hardware devices made sense when Bitcoin was at $1,000, if that makes sense. When Bitcoin's over $100,000, that becomes a little bit less tenable to hold meaningful wealth on a plastic device in your desk drawer. And so you've sort of seen this evolution of custodial standards sort of play out over the past 15 years as we move sort of to things like Michael helped build at Unchained with collaborative custody, and now what we're building with OnRamp and multi-institution custody and really providing the ability for larger pools of capital to get involved in size into this asset without unilaterally trusting a single entity. So that's sort of the broad concept of eliminating single points of failure in your custodial setup. Because I think if we take a bit of a step back and just think about sort of the unique custodial properties of Bitcoin being a digital bearer instrument, you necessarily have to think about custody in a different way, right? Like when people think about stocks and bonds in their portfolio, custody is an afterthought. It's not something that you think critically about because those are not typically bearer instruments, and they're certainly not digital bearer instruments like Bitcoin. So custody, as you know, I think we've hit on this a bit, but it's like custody is the most important thing in Bitcoin, in the sense that if you can't reliably secure your coins and propagate them into the future, none of the other aspects of the ecosystem or the price matter. So you have to be able to secure it in a reliable and redundant fashion. And so that is the sort of one component of why now. It's because now we actually can go implement this strategy where we can have basically a long-term orientation towards capital at risk, if you will. So whether it's the Bitcoin in the fund or the Bitcoin that we deploy to a founder or an entrepreneur, they need to be, you know, they need to have assurances that that Bitcoin is going to be there 10, 20 years from now. And I think up until this concept of multi-institution custody, I think that was arguable at best, that you could have that kind of long-term orientation with this asset. And so that's a major component. I think the other component is, you know, we touched on this a bit in the sense of what Sailor and MicroStrategy have done. We would be remiss not to say that that was, you know, a large piece of inspiration for what we want to accomplish with this fund. But the other realization is that effectively, you know, I think Sailor, or whether you look at a more recent example of Semler Scientific enacting a Bitcoin treasury strategy, in my mind, those are sort of outliers in the corporate space, in the sense that both of those individuals leading those organizations had enough voting control, voting power to make that unilateral decision to go about a Bitcoin strategy. For the vast majority of corporates and sort of smaller enterprises, that's not always going to be the case. And so I think they're sort of outliers on that far end of the spectrum. But what we're really trying to say is this is a rational, applicable strategy to anyone along that curve of sort of market cap and business size or business maturity. And if you go down the other side of the spectrum towards more of an early stage startup, there's typically founder entrepreneur control. And so if they can buy into the strategy, then they can implement the strategy more easily. And really, if zooming out again to like Bitcoin can help every business in the sense that it scales from your individual balance sheet as just a person sort of running your day-to-day expenses. Bitcoin can help you as a treasury asset. It can help small and medium-sized businesses, and it can help corporates, can help nation states. And so it's really just finding sort of segments of that continuum of cohorts that can benefit from Bitcoin, which is largely everyone in my mind, but finding those areas where the person in charge, the founder, has enough unilateral control to say, this is the decision we're making, we're committing to this. And then that feeds into everything else that they do from a capital allocation perspective. So I'll stop there, Brad, if you have anything to add to that.
No, I think that's a great summary. I think a lot of it also kind of goes back to this idea where, you know, you mentioned about just personal balance sheets and how, again, like I think, you know, ultimately, if you've been in Bitcoin for a cycle or two, you've gone through some pain, but you've also gone through some great victory and ultimately enjoyed just the mindset that it puts you in terms of lowering the time preference. But really starting to just, again, look at just overall economic decisions that need to be made on a personal level. And so I think, you know, Bitcoin's at a very unique time in its maturation. You know, it's, you know, currently sitting, you know, just a bit over $1 trillion. And I think based upon the price, but I would also say that there's also this huge influx of capital that is now starting to peak its interest. And so again, whether it be, you know, the ETFs coming in, whether it be other institutions, sovereigns, high net worth, family offices really starting to take notice. We really view this as an opportunity. Is this can be an asset for bedrock for businesses to start and really kind of anchor themselves in terms of something that will also give them more runway. I mean, a lot of people, if we look at the average, you know, life of a business, it's about 5 years for a startup. So if you think about that based upon Bitcoin cycle, well, if you ultimately are able to go build a quality business on a Bitcoin standard within that overall maturation or that time frame, then ultimately you're going to be setting yourself up for success long term, particularly if you're able to find that product market fit. So I think it's that also combined with just this concept that I think Mike Brian mentioned a little bit earlier, just about, you know, having been in the VC world in terms of like venture backed companies and seeing a lot of the waste and seeing what we can do today with all the different tools. And, you know, folks like Jeff Booth talk about a lot of the deflationary technology. And I see it, you know, every single day with, you know, the tools that I use. Man, we can go build some really important businesses, big businesses with, you know, at 1/10 of the cost. And so I think there's just such an incredible, powerful story that starts to come together where you have hard money, you have deflationary technology, you have this budding new industry, and ultimately it can really solve for a lot of, I'll just say, some of the downfalls that traditional venture capital has had, which is raise too fast, deploy too fast. And this puts a governor on that, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It gets people much more focused and focused on building versus focusing on where that next fundraising check's going to come from. So.
Well, and talking about that, I noticed that it's interesting because even though you're raising the fund in Bitcoin, deploying Bitcoin, operating on a Bitcoin standard, the companies that you invest in, you're not limiting yourself to Bitcoin only companies, as many of the funds that we've spoken with are. You, and probably that goes back to your thesis that both of you have shared, that you think ultimately every company will be a Bitcoin company. Just like every company is now an internet company, where it used to be a dividing factor. How are you sourcing the companies that you're looking at investing in, or what are the qualifications? What are the parameters that you would consider an investment, or how are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I've really put them into two different buckets. And what we would really deem is one would be a venture bucket, where we're finding, again, more traditional kind of, again, there's an idea, an entrepreneur with an idea that we can get in touch with just through our network. Or there's a build concept. And I'm going to preface this to say that I think where we stand today, just in Bitcoin as a whole, there's a ton of green space for us to go build infrastructure and require businesses that are just needed for us to get these bridges built from the traditional financial system into, again, a Bitcoin world. And so I think there's a ton of low-hanging fruit that we look at today. And I think, you know, OnRamp is a really good example of a business that was built on a Bitcoin standard, number one. But number two, also, there's all these adjacent industries that really come from multi-institutional custody that are going to be needed. I mean, we talked a little bit about custody at the corporate level. Well, there's a lot of other, I'll just say, adjacent products and services that can be built on knowing that you have a solid custody and governance structure now to actually hold the Bitcoin. But really what we look at here short term is like there's really that build opportunity where we can go find those entrepreneurs. There's gaps in the Bitcoin space today. And ultimately, they're really great targets for us to go partner with and ultimately go build alongside them with our advisor network. I think the venture network, in more of a traditional sense, we're very fortunate to have some incredible advisors at Early Riders that come from all types of backgrounds, whether they be pure play Bitcoiners, whether they be from the traditional finance realm, whether they actually have their own venture capital firms themselves, and accelerators. And a really good example of that is a gentleman named Cam Duty over at Brickyard VC in Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's an incredible, again, we'll just say network of individuals where we can start to tap into these various industries that, hey, we have these founders and they get Bitcoin, but they really want to focus on a supply chain opportunity. Well, yeah, certainly that could be something that we would consider. But I think in the short term here, there's just so much to be built in Bitcoin. So for us, it's really finding the infrastructure in Bitcoin that needs to be built today and then ultimately leaning into that really hard over the next, call it 18 to 24 months. And then we can start to broaden out once we see that there's maybe possibly some other venture opportunities for us to dive into.
Yeah, I would just add to that briefly that I do think in my mind there is sort of an order of operations in terms of those two segments, the build and venture. And with build, where we're really identifying infrastructure gaps in the market that will allow us to better identify venture investments that could benefit from Bitcoin. And so it allows you to move out into those adjacencies if you yourself go build the things that need to exist for that to proliferate. So in that sense, in terms of just our sort of early priorities, you could say we are focused on a few more of those sort of build opportunities, in the sense that, you know, I think there's also tremendous power in identifying individuals who have expertise in other domains outside of Bitcoin. Like there's a lot of great founders in Bitcoin startup founders, but there's also individuals out there who have their own domain expertise in whatever other industry, you know, they've built a career in, and they come to knowledge about Bitcoin like the rest of us do, and they start to see where those worlds start to meld. And so to us, you know, identifying those individuals who may not have been in Bitcoin for the past decade, but recently came to understand deeply the Bitcoin thesis, but they have this wealth of knowledge about this, you know, XYZ industry that they, in their mind, have now made that connection that, oh, wait, this can actually benefit from injecting Bitcoin into this business, whether it's the lowest hanging fruit of just a treasury management strategy or a treasury strategy, or actually integrating sort of the tech stack itself and allowing a business to interoperate globally. I think that's the other sort of component of, I would say sort of the primary thesis at least in sort of the TradFi circles around Bitcoin, is this sort of digital gold thesis, number go up, store of value. I think what I've tried to impart on people that I speak to about Bitcoin generally is like, that is sort of the floor in my mind. Like the digital gold thesis for Bitcoin is sort of the floor of what Bitcoin can be, its full potential. And it's really much more than that in sort of building an entirely new sort of monetary and financial system on better sound rails. And so I think for at least, you know, the easiest way to inject Bitcoin into your business is what Sailor has done, just purely from a financial perspective of using it as a treasury reserve asset, given it as a better form of money, and will help you sort of store your propagate your value into the future more efficiently. But beyond that, it's actually tapping into a more global total addressable market that's interoperable with other open protocols. I think that's something that's understated in sort of the realm of, well, how does Bitcoin fit into XYZ business? In reality, it kind of opens up the TAM of that business to this global network of not only consumers, but also builders. And so I think that's just another piece I would add there.
Okay, great. So the two segments, build and venture. So in the build segment, perfect, you're kind of co-building, cooperating. In the venture segment, is there any specific stage that you guys are looking to go into? I mean, how early are we talking, you know, seed, series A, is it kind of open? Are you aiming to be lead investors? I guess what direction can you give us there with the venture segment?
Yeah, in terms of the stage of the company and where they are, we're very early on. I think like it would take a pre-seed seed. Again, we very intentionally went out and built a bench of 8 advisors that span, again, a ton of disciplines, domain expertise, from anywhere from the technical components to from engineering to capital raising to operations to products. So we have this incredible bench for, you know, these entrepreneurs to tap into as advisors early and often. And so I think when we look at where we can go be as impactful as we can be, it's really getting in there early with those founders and entrepreneurs, understanding what they're building, and really being that trusted, you know, partner early on. And I think we joke a lot because we have a lot of discussions with just individuals who are interested in getting into the Bitcoin space. And we think talent is scarce. I mean, let alone Bitcoin being scarce, it's tough to find people that have either built in Bitcoin or who get Bitcoin and want to be in Bitcoin. And so I think what's becoming more and more of a value prop is you find these entrepreneurs that are driven, motivated, excited. They have this concept and idea. And really what they're looking to do is find a way to de-risk their transition from, we'll call it, the traditional way of their living today and their domain expertise to actually going and building in Bitcoin. And so what we're finding out is that there's a lot of people that sit in that boat, and then ultimately we're able to go help, you know, either introduce founders to other founders, and you start to really build these incredible teams that are, you know, coming out of the gates running and sprinting with incredible ideas and ultimately with a bit of, we'll call it, mental freedom to go really give it, you know, the best shot at making these businesses actually, you know, succeed and thrive.
When you, I mean, and maybe this will evolve over time, but the mix of companies that are Bitcoin educated and understand Bitcoin and the value of it versus those, perhaps an AI company, for example, that might be fast growing, could become part of the rails of the Bitcoin tech stack. Is it, I mean, are you having these conversations where you educate them on Bitcoin? And how do you see, I mean, an important conversation, something that Israel and I have talked with other guests about, is how do you see this changing the way they actually operate their business once they inherently come to understand a low time preference?
Yeah, I mean, that you just hit on a sort of a very core element of the thesis itself for the fund, in that we believe by using a better form of money as your unit of account, and actually using sort of the go forward price appreciation of Bitcoin as your hurdle rate, or in other words, your opportunity cost of any deployment of capital, that fundamentally alters how decisions get made. And so I think that is really at the heart of our thesis, in the sense that Bitcoin is the opportunity cost for us in our lives when I think about making personal capital allocation decisions. So it should be for our LPs, and it should be for our founders. And so that sort of gets to, you know, the rationale for why we're raising, deploying, and returning in Bitcoin terms. It's because that incentivizes better decision making in the sense of you just have a higher bar, you have a higher threshold for whether or not that piece of capital being deployed makes sense. If that's a good economic decision or not, you're raising that threshold. And so the outcome of that is better decisions and more value accretive decisions. And a lot of this also comes back to sort of Austrian theory in the sense of if money is free and can be infinitely printed, that necessarily leads to malinvestment. And so it's really flipping that on its head. And frankly, that's what we've seen for the past 20, 30 years in venture is a ton of malinvestment. And that's a direct function of the money being broken. We're flipping that on its head and saying, we found better money that isn't broken. We're going to denominate in it and assess all of our decisions, allocations against this threshold, this bar. And so, yeah, that's really at the core of it.
And it, you know, it's really interesting to hear you guys speak through some of these concepts, because anyone who has studied Bitcoin, what it is, you know, sound money, I think probably conceptually can understand where you're coming from. You know, maybe a follow-up challenge to that, especially in the stage that you guys are looking into, you know, pre-seed and seed, is I'm kind of faced as a early stage company with a tough conundrum, right? Let's say I understand everything you both explained, Brian and Brad. However, I'm at the stage of my business where I'm maybe not yet profitable, and just, you know, because I'm so early, I need growth capital. How do you help companies reason through this, you know, I guess this challenge of Bitcoin medium to long term is a very sound and sure bet, you know, let's say from, you know, the hard money aspects of it. But there's that short term volatility. So how do you help companies think through that treasury in the short term?
Yeah, I think what it really boils down to is it changes the way that you view value as a founder or operator or allocator. And again, like we really kind of view, because they are founders, entrepreneurs are allocators. Ultimately, the money that, you know, funds raise are ultimately given to operators and founders to go ultimately deploy to what they deem are good business decisions. And so what's really important is I think it puts a little bit of patience on the founder to say, you need to have these limitations. You need to be put into the scarcity mindset that will ultimately breed abundance, because the question is, do I hire Brian or can I do what Brian does in a more deflationary manner and ultimately find a better way, a better mousetrap to go solve the current problem that I have at hand? And in certain circumstances, yes, like there is going to be times where it's like, no, absolutely, you have to hire this specific individual, pursue this specific project. But what it really starts to at least to get down to the mind of the entrepreneur is, do you need to go spend $50,000 on Google Ads? Or really, do you just need to figure out a better mousetrap for acquisition? And you start to think again, I think a lot of where Michael and myself really came from pure play venture, and sometimes of the different businesses that we were working at. Michael being at a large, you know, SoftBank bats company. I was an A16Z bat company. It was just all of the money that was thrown in these different places to really things that really had no, I would say, future, given because everybody was so distracted. So I think it's that combination of weighing that opportunity cost every single day, building incrementally, and then just not throwing money at the problem. It's like, no, you can either solve it or you can ultimately clip some little bit of Bitcoin from the treasury. But then as you start to get into this revenue state, well, great. All of a sudden, the business starts to actually, generate some sort of cash, or it'll just say some sort of sats flow with Bitcoin. And so if we think about that being, you know, 4 years, that's probably very valuable sats that will ultimately provide a lot of value to that company in the future. So I think it's a different way of building, but ultimately we believe it is a foundational shift from what I think some of us have experienced in real life, but ultimately the businesses will just be so much more solid from a unit economics perspective. And I think that ultimately will show. just on who can, you know, come out of bear market stronger and ultimately go into that bull market, you know, thriving and ultimately growing, and then think about what is the bull.
The other couple components I would add to that, because it's a really good question, Israel, and it's something that we thought critically about when we were sort of you know, developing this thesis and thinking through how it would work practically. I think the first component is, like, there is some distorted sense of, like, what actually needs a massive amount of growth capital. And it's transitioning from this world where that was commonplace to a world where we can leverage increasingly efficient deflationary tools like AI to do more with less. And that's sort of a core theme of our thesis as well, is, like, by harnessing these deflationary technologies, software just very generally being one, but also, you know, AI and then Bitcoin, you can do a lot more than you think you could with a lot less upfront capital. And so it's transitioning from that world that's used to being flooded with dollars to a world that is operating on this, you know, finitely scarce asset, and just needing to think more critically about the deployment of that capital and also the, you know, specifically the value that they get out of it, right? The other sort of component to think about is, like, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be against one of our portfolio companies going out and raising dollars from someone else. So if they do truly need sort of a more near-term injection of capital, sure, go raise it from someone else. We're only going to give you the Bitcoin, which, you know, you're going to use sparingly because you know it's going to appreciate. And so that's another way to look at it, at least sort of more near-term.
Two other kind of things I would just add in there, Brian. I think that's a really good point, just thinking about the timing as well. So let's say you have a business that's actually starting to thrive and do well and, again, generate some SATS flow. Let's say there's a bit of a Bitcoin downturn. Well, you know, ideally they're in a decent enough position because they are generating some sort of revenue. Well, they could go do a raise in Bitcoin. And so ultimately they're showing up that balance sheet for the future, making sure that they're protecting, because they believe that there's a called a disproportion in the marketplace in terms of price. I think the other component that's really interesting, though, is in talking with some, you know, venture capitalists who get Bitcoin in the traditional space, their LPs don't want them touching. So they view that as a distraction, when in reality, these are folks that get Bitcoin. They're deep in the venture space. They're, you know, again, investing, allocating. But the LPs aren't quite on that page yet. And so I think what's really interesting is you start to think about co-investment opportunity down the road for early writers and others is, hey, these are, you know, again, folks that come to the table with Bitcoin, that's really what their expertise are, or we get looped into some of these other opportunities. And we've had those discussions, they've been great, but, you know, at the end of the day, I think Bitcoin is definitely, there's definitely a mindset to it. And I think a lot of us, I know everybody here on this call, certainly has weighed those decisions. You know, do you buy this, or do you put a little bit aside into Bitcoin? And I think ultimately when you start to, you know, get into that operator mindset, it certainly starts, you know, driving the right decisions.
One other thing to add there is just thinking about at a high level, like, the actual mechanics of, you know, making that decision to sell a portion of the Bitcoin, right? To go fund XYZ initiative, make, you know, that hire, whatever it may be, because you are using that as your hurdle rate effectively, the decision you're making necessarily needs to basically accrue more value, and that could be in fiat nominal dollar terms. And as long as you can outpace the, let's call it conservatively, a 25% to 75% annual CAGR, if you can outpace that in terms of ROI of whatever that capital deployment is, then you can always sort of cycle those cash flows or whatever the output of that deployment is back into Bitcoin. And so that's sort of the other way to think about it is, you know, something we like to say is, like, really every Bitcoin or every company is a Bitcoin miner to some extent. They're not, like, physically plugging in ASICs to mine Bitcoin, but they're in a different sense, they're, like, sort of mining the world of fiat cash flows, if you will, and creating more dollars out of a single dollar, but then using those dollars to sweep into sats. And so you're sort of mining Bitcoin in the sense of you're creating real value in the world, and you're sort of converting that economic energy into Bitcoin sort of programmatically. And so it's just a different way to think about, you know, because I think going back to what sort of we began to say at the beginning around, like, I think, you know, the Bitcoin only venture funds that exist today again, have sort of perhaps narrowed their opportunity set unnecessarily, in my mind at least, in the sense that, you know, as we transition to a Bitcoin standard, there's still going to be companies out in the real world that are producing value. And that value might be denominated in, you know, inflating dollars, but they're still creating excess value that can then be converted into a better form of money. So it's basically opening up that TAM of the sort of investable universe, if you will.
I want to circle back to something you said, Brad, and it ties in what you were talking about, Brian, the LPs and their perspectives. So if you have LPs, a universe of LPs that are perhaps less sophisticated about the technical opportunities or the foundational opportunities of Bitcoin as a technology, or Brian, to your early point when we started the conversation, they have difficulty conceiving of Bitcoin because they haven't been able to have an easy way to custody it. How do you bring on board with this investment thesis that's a little bit more open to traditional tech companies and bringing them on board? Does that help open it up to the universe of LPs or who would be? And understanding that when you're raising, this is not solicitation, but who would be an appropriate LP or who might be a target type of an LP for your fund?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one because I think what we've actually seen, at least early on, and this, you know, dynamic could change over time, but it's really, you know, the LP that is ideal for this fund is someone who already has Bitcoin effectively and has understood it for a certain amount of time. And not necessarily that this is even a, you know, I wouldn't go as far to say as it's a form of diversification because you still have, you know, the bulk of the return tied to the underlying currency unit, but it is a way, it is almost like we like to joke about it. It's somewhat of like a forced lockup of that Bitcoin, right? Like we all know the sort of hardest part about Bitcoin is just holding onto it and not doing anything with it for, you know, 5-10 years. And so if you can sort of deploy that Bitcoin into a fund where, you know, there's a Bitcoin denominated sort of hurdle rate that we're striving for. So ideally, you know, we're returning incremental Bitcoin back to you on top of the Bitcoin that you provide to us. It's not only a forced lockup so that, you know, you're not going to screw it up yourself. But it also is the potential for like some quote unquote yield on your Bitcoin is how I've also thought about it. But it's not yield in the sense of, you know, what we've seen historically in the Bitcoin market, which is, you know, very high risk and leverage based yield. It's actually, again, going out and leveraging real world productivity and value to accumulate more Bitcoin. And so I think that's at least what we've seen initially in the sense that, you know, I think our ideal LPs are Bitcoiners who understand Bitcoin pretty deeply. Have a certain amount that they're, you know, willing to allocate to something like this, and see the vision of what we're trying to do here with the thesis itself.
It's LPs are folks that really truly understand Bitcoin, the asset, and again the opportunity that lays, you know, in the next epoch to go deploy Bitcoin and ultimately build the next wave of infrastructure that's going to be required to onboard, you know, the next however many millions and hopefully billions of people that come to the asset. And, you know, I think a lot of the discussions that we get to have with, you know, prospective people that are just interested in our thesis is walking folks through our large four core themes and, having these deep discussions with them about, you know, how has traditional investment, you know, how is it different from this? And how would you change your point of view as an operator or founder if this was how you were forced to set up a business? And I think, a lot of Bitcoiners, I can say, that, you know, again, I think just by nature, they're incredibly crafty, they're scrappy, they really have an incredible entrepreneurial just spirit. And I think what's really cool about a lot of the LPs and prospective people that we do talk to and just individuals, they embody that a lot. And I think that's, you know, a pretty big requirement is, you know, being able to bear down, do the work. It's not just like a allocate, walk away type of deal. So it's a lot of fun. I mean, a lot of the folks who get adopted, they want to go build in the space, which is a very unique person.
No, value creation, I think, is how Brian termed it, you know, which I love.
Yeah.
And this is another conversation that Israel and I've had with some of our other guests is just how investing in Bitcoin, the return to the LPs. So this could change over time. Typically, an LP in a venture fund today is expecting an exit public IPO or a sale of the company to others, that, and they get a disbursement. But you're dispersing to your LPs in Bitcoin. You talked about maybe a rate of return on it. And this is a concept that's come up where maybe venture funds become almost like utility companies of old, you know, the old utility company model where you had dividends or returns that came to you. Instead of companies needing to exit, they just end up generating real value and real cash flow that they then return to you, the investor, investing fund, and you return to the LPs. Is that kind of the model that you're envisioning, or can you expand on that?
Yeah, it's definitely something that we've thought critically about. And as a brief aside, like this particular concept sort of goes back to a lot of, again, my knitting from traditional finance and really growing up in the value investing world. And, you know, I don't remember if it was Buffett or Ben Graham who said something to the effect of, like, you know, the ideal time horizon is like indefinite. Like, you ultimately don't ever want to sell a business, because if you're selling it, it's like you're okay with parting with some component of that business. If it's the best business ever, you never want to sell it. And so I think there ideally will be a component of what you're referencing where we might not have any intent to sell the business, but are just generating cash flows, sweeping them into Bitcoin and distributing to our LPs in the form of dividends.
And I think just to tack on that, because I think, Brian, you were probably an employer that was public. There's just a lot of baggage that comes along with being a publicly traded company. And I think when you look at founders and builders these days and how messy the cap table has got between 2014 to 2020 for these venture-backed businesses, I mean, imagine a world where you have a company that has two or three, organizations, funds, people, whomever on the cap table, and those founders are just focused on building. Like, what a crazy concept. And maybe they just stay private for a long time. They're able to generate this immense amount of cash flow and value to its investors. And yeah, maybe there's, at some point, one of them or two of them wants to go public. But I think there's all these different, additional baggage that comes along with being that publicly traded company. I think, it goes back to the thesis. If you can build on a Bitcoin standard, idea with that cap table is, again, a lot cleaner. That's kind of our thesis, at least, that founders might only have to raise two or three times. And they're focused on building. They're providing value to their investors. And whether it's an exit or whether it's, some sort of, SATS flow or dividend flow, it ends up being a pretty nice deal for everybody involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, well executed, it kind of goes back to why you go into building a business in the first place, right? Which is to create value. Be profitable, not just kind of scheme the system and try to grow and exit, right? Which is unfortunately some of the symptoms we've seen in the past few decades. So I mean, it's great to, I know we're kind of, closing up on time here, but it's great to get into the nuts and bolts of what you guys are doing at Early Riders, I guess. Where are you in as far as timeline goes, Brian and Brad? I mean, you're actively fundraising, and when are you looking to deploy the capital? Maybe if you could give listeners, a quick picture as far as timeline of the fund.
Yeah. So in terms of timing, in terms of deploying all the capital, we view our fund in epochs. So again, what's really nice about being a Bitcoin fund is you sit on Bitcoin. They're never short Bitcoin in the fund. So we don't have the urgency to go deploy cash. It's in Bitcoin. And so I think that's a very unique angle that we do that. In terms of fundraising, yeah, we're in the process of that. Again, can't speak too much, again, to the fundraising components. But members of the team, Brian, myself, Mitch, Michael, we will all be in Nashville. There'll be OnRamp has a number of different events along with the Early Riders representation there as well. And so, we're excited to be in Nashville again, be able to talk with people ultimately, again, have discussions about our thesis and pressure test that with folks that are, again, looking to learn more and ultimately understand kind of our approach to the new investment landscape using Bitcoin as a unit of account.
Great. So Israel and I will also be in Nashville at the Bitcoin 2024 conference. So If you're listening to this after that's already occurred, then the best way is to reach out to you guys. We'll include your Twitter and any other touch points of how people should reach you. But if not, if people will be at Bitcoin 2024, then I know I've seen on the Twitter for OnRamp the list of events that you're hosting. And so people can reach out to you to see if they can meet you in person there. Is that the
Multiple ways to reach out. You can email at us at hello@onrampbitcoin.com. My email is also brian@onrampbitcoin.com. And we also have one event which you actually can RSVP through a link that we'll provide. We're sort of hosting quote-unquote office hours on a few of the days there. So if you're going to be in town and you want to learn more about what we're doing either at Early Riders or at OnRamp, just reach out to us, schedule some time, and we'll have a chat with you.
I also want to give a shout out to your podcast, to the OnRamp team podcast, because I've been a listener since it launched. And especially if you have more of an institutional mindset, I think it's just an outstanding podcast to kind of get perspectives on global macroeconomics, how institutions, family offices, asset allocators can be thinking about Bitcoin. So really want to compliment you guys on an excellent effort there too.
Thanks, Lynn. I really, really appreciate that. And getting into the podcast game over the past several months has given me I always listen to podcasts, but actually doing them myself has given me an even greater appreciation for the medium. So it also been very nice to get to know you through your guys' podcast. You guys are crushing it and putting out a lot of high signal content.
Well, thank you, Brian and Brad. We truly do appreciate you guys coming on to the podcast. Just a second, Lynn's shout out to the OnRam Media podcast, highly recommended. And hopefully anyone listening can catch you guys in Nashville. And we personally look forward to also seeing you in Nashville soon. So, really appreciate the time.
Awesome. Thank you guys for having us.